In a world of podcasts, one rises in the night to destroy them all. The Elder God in an ocean of noise, the Cthulhu of the airwaves. This is Spoiler Country.
Hey, welcome back to Spoiler Country. My name is Kenrick. Today on the show, we are lucky and just so pleased to have somebody who, if you are an indie comics fan, you're in the sphere of, we have all these collaboration groups. If you're an indie comic book creator, there's Discords, there's Facebook chats, there's all this stuff. And Dave and I met through Dave and I met on Blue Sky, which is weird, of all the places to reach out and start talking to each other. But that's what it was. And then we found out, we're friends with all these same people. And he's got a new Kickstarter out called Armageddon Quest. So we're going to kind of go over everything, share it, and talk about the book, how Dave got into it. And you also might know him with his Wine and Pairing Show, Wine and Comics Pairing Show. Is that right?
Yes. That's correct.
Yes. And it's a great podcast, a great YouTube show. He's got some awesome guests, and they talk about comic books. They talk about life, and then they pair the book that they're talking about with a wine. And Dave has amazing insights on wine. I love wine. I love drinking wine. I know lots of different types of wine, but I do not have the knowledge that Dave has when it comes to wine. So if you're going to have a dinner party, good guy to ask. Hey, yes. What do you think of this? You'll probably be like, you should go with this, this, and this. Also loves to edit. He is kind of you're kind of a man of all ages lately.
A bit of a renaissance guy. Yes, 100%. Not that I love all aspects of the renaissance that I'm deep within at this point. Like some of the marketing, I would love to shuffle off to a Blake Morgan, a Blake's Buzz out there. I just can't do it yet. But but it's nice because I think when you're hands on about these things, it's good to learn for yourself how things work, how it doesn't, what the timelines are. How many man hours it actually takes to do every piece of something like creating a comic, publishing a comic, doing a fundraiser. Oh my God. And then if I do ever hire someone, I'm going to have empathy. I'm not going to be one of those people that's just going to be like, why aren't you just getting me 1,000 followers? I don't understand.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm going to be like, no, it's fucking hard. And the fact that you got me 5 followers, you moved heaven and earth to get me 5 fucking followers.
You moved the needle.
This is great.
Yeah. Dave Baxter. Welcome to the show, buddy.
Good to be here.
I'm glad to have you on. It's been a minute. I came on your show, I think October, maybe September.
Yeah. October, November, something like that.
Yeah.
Whenever your Supernatural Baby Detective, the first Kickstarter was still happening.
Yep. Yeah.
And we paired wine with Supernatural Baby Detective. So go watch that. And find it. And all because of us, I swear.
That's right. That's right. I was on the cusp.
Go find that episode. Find out what wine we paired with Supernatural Baby Detective.
Armageddon Quest, man. Let's get into it for a little bit. Because you and I are both chatterboxes. We will end up talking until the cows come home if people let us. And we might skip over why we're here. So I want to get into Armageddon Quest, how you found it, what drew you to it, what was the catalyst that made you fall in love with this story? Because this is something that came out in the mid-80s to the early 90s, and you loved it so much. It's out of print, so you said, I'm going to bring this back. I'm going to talk to the creator. We're going to bring this back. And you and your cohort, Dallas, it was awesome. I love Dallas. He has great questions. He really does. Good insights. And I'm just so curious why was this the one to put your money where your mouth is, so to speak?
So Armageddon Quest is, for those unfamiliar with the comic, which is everybody, for those unfamiliar with the comic, this is an actual classic 1980s underground black and white comic. It was created between 1984 and 1992. It had a brief flickering moment of spotlight where it was published in its entirety By Sirius Publishing, the guys who were behind like Poison Elves and Dawn and Cry for Dawn, very popular comics back in the 90s.
Joe Dawn Michael Lissner were huge.
Yeah, yeah. And the artist of Cry for Dawn did the covers of those OG Armageddon Quest graphic novels back in the day. Really beautiful covers. They don't really represent the work very well, which is one of the things, like the style of the insides is a very different from like the lush, fully painted stained glass window style of art that you're going to get from Joseph Michael Lissner. So yeah, I definitely wanted to correct that this time around and be like, I wanted covers that really represented what the interiors of the comic were going to look like. Those covers are beautiful.
The guy was a little bit ahead of his time on his art, because what he's did then is popular now. You look at Nickelodeon, you look at Rick and Morty, you look at, Adventure Time and all the, those are all in that vein of what his style of art is.
I agree. I think one of the reasons I'm confident that we can find a new audience for this comic book these days is that, the readership, I think the curiosity, one, the fact that it is a artifact of comics history is something that people are actually very curious about. And the fact that this comic exists, it's 900 pages all told. The entire series is
That's
done.
That's a lot.
Our first issue, which is on Kickstarter right now, is 52 pages. The first 52 that we're putting out, that's the first chapter, the first quote unquote book. And I think the fact that this comic, it came out, Sirius went under shortly after they released the book. So it sort of had its brief flickering moment in the spotlight and then disappeared. I mean, I've been looking for people who know about this work for decades and no one does. And it's killed me to this day. And this is my favorite comic of all time. It is my number one. If you ask me what are my top 10 comics, my top five, my top three, this is number one. And it has been since I read it in the 90s and nothing has taken its place. So
how old are you? How old are you when you picked it up?
Middle school. I think seventh grade. So I would have to do the exact year math on what exact age that put me in, but it would, it was either sixth or seventh grade, because I know where I lived at the time, which was Northern Virginia, and we were only there for sixth and seventh grade. I think it was seventh grade. And it's fun because even if it was seventh grade, you're still pretty young then. And the 90s were a time when not safe for work comics, there was a lot of hullabaloo about don't let kids see any mature readers, because Vertigo was on the rise, the mature readers imprint at DC. You were having Marvel was even experimenting a little bit at the time. That did not last, but they had this Marvel UK imprint that was mature readers only. Liam Sharp
Marvel
did
had the magazines.
First books and magazines, but the magazines weren't in comic shops mostly, which is why they got away, right? But in comic shops, it's weird to me because they're like, but it's for kids. And I'm like, were kids ever in comic shops? I mean, really? How many children spent a lot of time in comic shops, especially by the 90s? I'm like, by the 90s, it was mostly older teens and adults. Let's just be honest with ourselves here. We had already aged into that and the kids weren't coming that much anymore. I don't think I went to a comic shop until I was fourth or fifth grade or something like that. And I was only there occasionally. I couldn't drive myself. I could only go there when, my mom would take me there. And my mom was not, we did not live a lifestyle. And she was not the kind of person where it was like, oh, I'll take you whenever you ask, darling. It's no, that's
right.
So it was, I got to go once in a while. But even though that was a time period where there was a lot of freakouts of, don't let kids see it. Comic shop owners would put the board in front of the cover and then it would be in the bag. So no one could see if the cover was suggestive, even just suggestive in any way. They're like, no, let's not do that. Some comics were actually shipped in black bags. So you couldn't mags. So you couldn't see what the thing is. So Armageddon Quest is not safe for work. And it's not safe for work in how we traditionally think of that. It's not sexy in the thrilling, sexy way. It's not violent in the thrilling, sexy way. It's its own beast.
It's not Tim Vigil.
It's not Tim Vigil. They're not. I mean, I'm sure some people are going to look at this art and read this story and find some scenes kind of hot. I mean, they're going to be out there. some scenes more than others. Some scenes are very, some scenes are going to require trigger warnings, you know, in future issues, not this first issue. No one needs a trigger warning for this first issue, but what's to come can get a little heavy. And no one, plainly the comic shop owners hadn't even read these graphic novels because they were just out for yeah. anyone to buy. And my seventh grade ass bought them and no one said bupkis. No one said a word. And this was like the comics were in their black bags right next to this thing, but they were in the bargain bin and it was all the whole series kind of in one little package. And I think it was $10 or something like that, which for my, at my age and in those years, like $10 was
a lot of money
for me. Yeah. But the sheer amount of comics I got for it, 900 pages. And I hadn't counted it at that point, but I just, you could see the thickness and and I was like, oh yes, I'm doing this. And so instead of going to the racks to get some more Marvel DC stuff, which I was looking for something to read on a family car trip. We were going to drive this like 16-hour car trip. And I was like, I need something to read. This is going to be long. This is going to be hellish. And I want something to lose myself in. And I went, I bit the bullet. I was like, okay, leap of faith. I'm buying these. And I read all 900 pages in that one car trip. I could not stop. I could not take my eyes off it. I could not, I didn't want, every time we stopped to eat or do a bathroom break, I was annoyed. I did not want to stop because I would have to put it down and go do something else. So I had rarely had that experience with fiction of any kind before this comic. It impacted me. It left an imprint on me. I think it was truly my first indie comic, my first true blue indie comic that I'd ever read. And it blew my little mind. And it blows adults' minds, too, like when they read this. It is a truly unique voice, a truly unique style. It has shades of things you've seen before. It's not one of those things where it's like you have no context for where to even place it. No, you will. It's not that bad. I do like to compare it to like the OG black and white Eastman Laird TMNT, Usagi Yojimbo. I always say Robert Crumb, too. You got to throw some of him in there. And those sort of Chester Brown and like those black and white greats of that era when they were really pushing the boundaries on adult content in underground comics. And Armageddon Quest, it is a fantasy heroic epic. It's the coming of age story of the Antichrist. He's a reluctant Antichrist. He's kind of a nice kid, doesn't want to hurt anybody, doesn't want to end the world. But the world, like, I mean, his mother hates him because she knows he's the Antichrist, and her story gets told in a future issue where you learn all the shit she went through as the mother of the Antichrist before, like leading up to his birth. And it's, she has good reason to have some horrible thoughts about her own child. But this kid, nevertheless, you know, it's one of those things. He doesn't understand that it's not something he has to learn about how the world works. He has to learn about how people work. He has to learn about religion, about politics, about why all these different factions of the world want him to fulfill his destiny. I mean, he's the villain, but it's like he needs to be the villain because there are parts to play, right? And there's a prophecy to fulfill, and everyone's banking on this to happen in a certain way. So it's one of, like, even as a child, one of the first things in this first issue you'll see is like there's a he grows up in a Italian villa. So it's right near the Vatican. It's right near like the worst place he could possibly be. And the local priest is always kind of poking his nose around. And his caretakers that are raising him are always like, don't talk to the priest. Like, you know, that priest will fucking kill you if he knows who you are, you know, kind of thing. So he has to learn about the world and what they want of him. And why. And this whole series, it's his coming of age into young adulthood. Once he hits young adulthood, that's where it really gets not safe for work. You got to be ready for that. He comes into his own sexuality. And this comic was a little ahead of its time in a number of ways. There are characters here that are all about gender fluidity. They're all about, not that this language is used in the comics. It was kind of having this language to talk about it.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of playfulness in terms of sex and gender, and a lot of openness with sexuality. And it goes a lot of different places. And again, as a kid, I was like, I couldn't believe I was reading this in a comic book. Like, this was something where it's just like, and it's an actual kind of heroic fantastical supernatural horror epic. And I mean, I was flipping those pages. I could not. And it, let me tell you something else. It is not. It is a dense comic textually. There's a lot of writing in this comic as well as the beautiful images. It's not a fast read. The fact that I finished this thing in 16 hours was like, I did not stop. I did not break. I don't even think I napped during that time. And we got up at like 4 a.m. to start that car ride. And, you know, we arrived at like midnight all the way around the next day. And it was just like, oh, it was so.
I go right back to the beginning and start it over.
Like, seriously. Well, I mean, I've reread it so many times since. It is a comic I can read at a drop of a hat, which is fascinating to me, actually, even just saying that right now. I don't think I've said this in any other interview yet, but Armageddon Quest is one of the, like, my top, if I had to make a top five or top 10 comic list, a big piece of that is going to be what can I, what will, like, I don't have to be in the mood. Like, I always want to read that comic. Like, it's, even if it's heavy, even if it's textually dense, even if it's unique in some way, like it has a certain voice where it's like, that's uncommon. It still is something that affects me in a way where it's like, I can just pick it up and I can crack it. Now I know the story front and like the back of my hand at this point. So like I can open it up at any point too and just start reading. And I can do that
pick
with
up wherever
at any
it's
time.
At.
And it, yeah. And it always satisfies me. It's always worth re-looking at. And so to answer, that was a very long-winded version of why this comic, but it is my favorite comic of all time. And it kills me that no one has heard of it, that it got lost to history, that there are the few handful of people that do remember it. We got a nice pull quote from Scott McCloud because he did remember the comic. And he's like, that was an amazing comic. And I'm like, dude, yeah. I'm like, thank you for that. That's amazing. One person that also remembered it and gave us an amazing pull quote that we're not using anymore. We got this pull quote quite a while ago, and he is now kind of persona non grata to the rest of civilization. But Warren Ellis remembered this comic and gave it a really nice pull quote at one point. And so the folks that remember it very fondly, like me. Yeah. There just aren't many of them. And I think that has been a tragedy to me personally, even though I didn't make the damn thing for so long
Do you think that it's the, not the genre, but the way in which I looked it up now. I can't remember who was the writer of this.
Ronald Russell Roach.
Yeah. Ronald. How do you say his last
Russell
name?
Roach. like Russell a cockroach. Roach. Roach.
Yeah, 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 Russell Roach. Yeah, yeah. Do you think it was the actual the stuff that he's talking about? Is it the way that he wrote it that just kind of gravitated and pulled your attention? That like this is talking to a young Dave and saying, I am really like I really connect with this in some way. Mm-hmm. And is it more about the way he writes? Or do you think it's more about what he's writing about?
It was definitely the way he wrote about it more than what. I mean, what was something that intrigued me? But I mean, there are lots of movies, comics, books, you name it, stories that the premise sounds absolutely fucking fantastic. And then you read it and you're like, all right, basic. All right. You know, straight. Yeah. It's like I read. It's like reading it is like reading the premise. You're just getting it in very straightforward, bare bones fashion. That has its place. And sometimes maybe the premise itself can blow someone's mind. I think when you read a lot, though, when you are, and I think a lot of people who read comics are people who read a lot because we're all nerds, we're all geeks, we're all dorks, and we consume a lot of media. And when you do that, I think the need to find something different, like a new version of the things you love, is more. I know there are some people in the world that don't seek that out. I don't understand that in any way, shape, or form. I think there are people that I think the reason most people don't seek it out is not because they don't want to seek it out, but because they have this sort of deep-seated belief that, you know, if it's truly worth their time, they're just going to hear about it. Like they don't have to seek it. out. It's going to be
You're missing out on so much stuff.
I know. But I do think that like that's sort of why marketing works as well as it does, right? Like when there's a lot of money behind the marketing, and it's like when that thing is being broadcast everywhere, everyone wants to be a part of the conversation. Everyone wants to weigh in on what that thing is because it's fucking everywhere and everyone's talking about it. And when then no one is talking about something, there is just that suspicion that this is some piece of shit little ditty that like some self-published whatever somewhere that like is not worth their time. No one put a bunch of bucks behind it. And so why with all, and especially nowadays, we're so spoiled for riches when it comes to content and media, you know, there's so much available to us that it's like, why am I taking time and or money for this thing? I'm still, because I found so many things by taking that leap of faith and finding the things, like I get intrigued when I haven't heard about something. And sure, you can look into something and dig a little deeper into it and be like, oh, okay, this is a really like not ready for prime time, somebody's, you know, vanity project that no one cares about. Okay, maybe I will pass on that one. But when I see something that actually looks quality in some way, whether it's the art, whether it's the writing, something about it that catches my attention, and it is just this,
or the idea is so unique,
or, you know, the art style is something that just like you halts you in your tracks and you're like, wait a minute, where did you come from? And do you just do art or are you, do you do narrative stuff? Like, is it something I can read that, that you do? And so you dig a little deeper into that. And when I find things like that, that's what I live for, honestly, as a reader and as a consumer. I think that that is the best thing that you can experience.
That's like, for my book Supernatural Baby Detective, that's my biggest push. I think that's the biggest thing I have. I mean, it's original. I don't think you're gonna go out there and you're gonna find anything that's doing what that book has done and what it's doing, you know. And it's, and sometimes I get frustrated because I hear people, because they'll be like, oh, I don't know how
to compare,
tell you about it's a baby detective. I'm like, if that's what you got out of it, then I failed, because that's not all that's going on there.
Well, and I will say, not everyone is good with words. Not everyone is good with, you know, and that's part of the, I think a lot of creators can be like that too, where it's like they're good at telling stories, but then, you know, the moment you ask them to pitch their shit, it's like they're like, they just get this block. This mental block, and it's like they can't get past, and they're, and all of a sudden you're like, didn't you just write a fucking novel or write a fucking 900 page comic epic? Like, how are you
give
not
me the
able
highlights, buddy?
Right, exactly. And you know, but some, but brains don't always work that way, right? It's like some personalities and the way we think about things, like someone can sit there and let an idea percolate and just map it out and so, and then create it on their own steam in their own way, and from beginning to end, and that is something they understand. That is something they feel confident about. If you're like, now distill, but that took you, you made 900 pages of comics. Now distill it into a log line, and that is its own skill. That is not the same thing.
It's almost like asking a band.
Wordsmithery.
Yeah, it's almost like asking a band, what genre of music are you guys? And you hear it, and you can see their gears rolling, and they're like, and they don't want to say we're rock and roll or we do heavy metal or, or like, what do you sound like? Well, we don't sound like, and sometimes I always kind of, because I love to tease people, and it gets me in trouble all the time, because either they get it or they think I'm an asshole, and it's fine.
Right.
But they always, you know, it's like, oh, so you invented this whole new genre of music. You must be a genius.
Right. Although to be fair, to their credit, I, you know, musicians didn't create these genres, right?
That's right.
They're not the ones who invented them. They didn't have any reason to. They didn't need these lines drawn in the sand. They didn't need these things defined in such boxed ways. That was for stores. People selling the music desperately needed them.
Yeah.
And so they were like, okay,
marketing.
If you just have, if you just have a record store, it's like, it's one thing when there's only a two dozen bands that anyone gives a shit about at one point in history, kind of a thing, you know, and you're like, okay, well, you're here for the Beatles or you're here for Elvis or
you're here for the Rolling
Stones,
blues
and jazz or what have you. But see, even then, it's sort of like the moment you start branching out, the moment you've got blues and jazz and country and rock and roll and pop, and then you're going to start having things like bluesgrass, and like, because even within country it starts breaking down into other genres, and now we've got
genres and subgenres and subgenres of that,
blah, blah, blah. Yes, And but this was to sell things so people could go, and bookstores were the same thing too, right? Yeah. It was like bookstores needed suddenly, you know, the, and people's biggest gripe is the fact that there is still just an overall section called fiction. People hate that, you know, because they're like, what's in that section? We're not even sure. You know, it's like, what are you? Because, okay, sci-fi fantasy, you gave sci-fi fantasy or speculative fiction, if you want to lump them together, you gave them that. Nonfiction has their breakdowns of things. You know, it's cooking, it's gardening, it's history, it's politics, something like that. Bios.
How did we get here?
We're talking about selling things and marketing. But the fiction thing is still a problem because it's like going into a movie store, you know, like when rental stores still existed.
Oh, yeah.
And the new release, everyone got that. But if you just had a movie section that like nothing else fit in, people would not like that and not really respond to that very well, unless you were a fucking weirdo like me and you were just like, that's where you find the weird shit, let's go there.
So, I worked at Hollywood Video in the mid-90s, and I kind of miss going into a rental place and seeing all those cover boxes, because that's how I found The Evil Dead. You know, that's how I found The Reanimator. That's how I found, I have tons of movies. True Romance, you know, was from seeing the cover box and going, that looks cool. And then picking it up and reading the back going, oh, I want to check this out. And then being blown away when I watched it going,
absolutely. I mean, that period, kind of like, okay, now here we'll circle back to a little bit to Armageddon Quest with this, but Sometimes those covers were so amazing they misrepresented how bad the movie actually was, or how not really, like, the cover was so much better than the movie could ever be.
Yeah, like Deathstalker.
Deathstalker, like a lot of the horror movies.
Rapefest.
Rapefest. Or the worst part, I did do Deathstalker 1 through 4 in one evening one time, and it blew me away how much every subsequent, like Deathstalker 2 had some scenes from Deathstalker 1 they just replayed. Deathstalker 3 had scenes from 1 and 2, and it was like half the movie. And Deathstalker 4 is almost entirely scenes from 1, 2, and 3.
I watched Deathstalker
reassembled
when it came out in the early 80s, like on HBO or Showtime. And I loved it because I shouldn't have been watching it because I was like 10.
Of course.
You know, 9 or 10 years old. Should not have been watching it, but it was fan. And I loved Beastmaster, and I loved, you know, all those, you know, and Beastmaster was fine for a 10-year-old. I mean, there are some scenes that are kind of questionable, but it wasn't that bad.
80s fantasy was a little risque, but
it wasn't Deathstalker. And I remember going, oh, I really liked Deathstalker when I was a kid. And then we did an episode for Spoiler Country, and we did a review of Deathstalker, and I hadn't watched it in 30 years, 40 years, you know? So I'm like, let's do it. And we all watched it, and we all got together, and we're like, whoa, that was a whole lot of rape. We had even the heroes were just raping girls. It was like,
I know.
What?
It's not a good movie in any way, shape, or form. No, I mean, like, you can enjoy
it. Redeemable like, about it.
No, it's terrible. And the sequels are worse because they are recut patchwork monstrosities of the previous films. It's hysterical. I mean, like, I couldn't believe that movies could be made like that, and I wasn't aware that this was a thing in movies, like really low budget thing, like small producers that would reassemble movies, or people that would take foreign films and reassemble them with like 10 minutes of new footage and weave a whole new story around it, like hire one white actor and then film his scenes as though he were interacting and with like intercut the Asian cast. Yep, and intercut him in. And all of a sudden you had a whole new movie. And I was like, holy shit, this is horrible. But
it's genius though.
It's genius. Well, it's genius because it worked at the time because we were not a global community yet, right?
Yeah.
It's like we didn't have access to each other.
You couldn't do that now.
Right. Foreign films just used our soundtracks. They would just use them in the film because we had no idea what they were doing. We didn't care either, really. And we didn't have any eyeballs into it. Nothing was coming over, and we weren't sending anything much over there except the biggest of the big.
So they just take the scores and use them.
Yeah. But to that point, like I worked at a Blockbuster for a little while as well.
Oh,
back in the day.
Enemy.
The enemy. Hollywood was so much better. I loved, I was, I'm with you in the sense that I swear by Hollywood. Of the two bigs, biggest.
The only reason Hollywood was better was this. You walked into Hollywood and you had late fees. You had $70 worth of late fees. Me as a cashier could say, give me $5 towards your late fees and you can still rent. I don't care.
Right.
And Blockbuster was the exact opposite. No. Pay in full.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. Blockbuster was, I mean, because they were the big guys.
Yeah.
Like they were the Disney of the group. And like there was no the
big bad
negotiating with Disney, you know?
Yeah.
But the one thing, and I do miss that, I'm nostalgic for it because I grew up with it and it's a very fond memory. But I will say to this day, I spend when I'm winding down for bed most nights and I'm like, I sit down and cuddle with my cat for 30 minutes to an hour for the final thing. I always want to read, but I sometimes wind up scrolling on my phone, right? It's like, yeah, you just get sucked into that and you're like, God damn it, I'm spending too much time on my phone. But one of my fun things that I do on the phone is like, I will pull up like Vudu or Amazon Prime or whatever the catalogs are. And it's like the new releases and the indie releases that now have their own.
I flip through it.
And you still discover things that you are like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
So I still treat the apps and the digital sphere that we're living in now, the streaming world, as a video rental store. And I think you can still get a lot of that out of these experiences. You have to bother to do it. But I if you scroll,
you just miss the community aspect of it.
A little bit. I'm on Letterboxd as well. I think it's all online. I know. But it's like there's online communities. I live in a major city. I'm in LA, so I'm sure there probably are there are all these event websites where you can sign up for groups that do meet in person and do things we're all gonna get together, watch a movie, and then talk about it. Where I've got my first this weekend, I'm meeting up with my first wine group, which is bring your own bottle wine group that I've never tried before, but it's like everyone's got to bring a bottle of wine that's $25 or more, but you know, no less than we're not gonna risk finding the hidden gems. Don't give us cheap shit, you know, bring something that's at least medium, you know, at $25 and then or more, and everyone brings one bottle and we all try it and we all talk about it. And I'm like, I miss this. Okay, great. But
just 12 miles from my house is an actual video store still.
Yeah.
And they've been around since the late 80s. They've been there.
Yeah.
And they still rent VHS and they still rent DVD and they're right next to Jalisco's Mexican restaurant. And they've been there the whole time and it's crazy. And the Blockbuster video that was there only closed in 2013, 2014. Cause when we were there, we rented a house,
a few hangers on
in Bothell. It was there. We're like, holy shit. There's a Blockbuster video still here. And then it was gone like a month later, 2 months later.
And now they're all gone, but there is a video store by my parents, in their small town, Michigan Petoskey place up there.
Bend, Oregon. Family still has a Blockbuster.
Yeah. So, oh, does it? So there is one.
Yeah. The last Blockbuster in the world is in Bend, Oregon.
Gotcha.
I don't think it'll ever close. Cause it's kind of been it's become a
cultural artifact, right? It's what do they call it? It's something that you need to preserve that is anyway, cultural preservation worthy thing.
You know, it's It's like, what do they call that?
There's
when you're on the historical society, it's like they could put it, it's an historical landmark.
Right. It's like, no one can ever tear it down. No one can ever get rid of it. It's like, this is a piece and it's one store. Let's do it. You know, let's preserve it. Let's keep it forever.
Yeah.
But I do think that, where was I just going with that in, going back to the comic. So I think long story short with all of that, in the same way that, you know, you're doing Supernatural Baby Detective, which is a unique new indie comic on Kickstarter. Yeah. We're bringing an old comic that is like, this is the kind of thing that you would need to go to. And you would need to find a comic shop that had like a real back issue, not just like Marvel and DC, but like tons of back shop. And you would still have to somehow find it in all those bins and whatnot.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, well, I think online is,
you'd even find it.
Yeah,
how lucky,
or even know what it was or have any context. So you might see it.
How many issues were printed? Sorry, how many issues were printed?
I don't know. I've never spoken to the OG publisher. You can still find copies floating around, so they're out there. The first trade paperback is actually fairly affordable if you try to go spelunking. The second and third, not so much. That one can get those two can get a little pricey. But they are, the one thing I will say, and I'm very confident about this, is the new editions, we have a lot of bells and whistles that the old editions do not have. We are going to be releasing like Ron's back catalog. Like there are prelude stories. There are illustrated prose stories. There are hundreds of pages of prelude comics that he did on the characters before launching into Armageddon Quest directly. And we're going to be reprinting all that.
That's a good sign of really good character development.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Because there's a lot of people just, especially when it comes to comic books, and I've met lots of people that do independent comic books, and they're all wonderful people. But when I read their characters, it's like, oh, you just wrote this guy.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's
he's a type. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this was something where Ron originally wrote the entire story as a novel. And then he was like, yeah, okay, I don't know what to do with this, you know, this novel. And I think he was like, I can still do it better. It's one of those things that was like his practice run. Then he started writing. He was working as a security guard. And in a prison in either Washington or Oregon. I'm going to forget which one. I think Washington. And he was working as a security guard at a prison there. And he started writing the character that will be, he's going to be introduced in a future issue, but the Christ character of the comic, not the Antichrist, but the Christ character called Emmanuel. And he wrote this in hundreds of pages of Emmanuel hijinks in this prison and doing certain things.
This makes me want to read this more. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The fact that he did all this prep work is amazing.
Yes. And did as stories with our Antichrist Tazio long before he started the official Armageddon. So the cool thing about Armageddon Quest is this is not his practice run. This is his like, all right, I'm ready.
Yeah.
Real.
This is magnum opus when it comes to this.
Exactly. And you can tell the art and the storytelling is, you know, one thing I've mentioned in the past to some folks is, when you go back, even though I've compared this to Eastman and Laird's TMNT, the really early black and white issues, if you go back and read those first early issues, the storytelling is not very good, right? It's like, it's fun, but they didn't know what they like. And their art skills, even their art skills would improve quite a bit as they went and fairly quickly. But it was still, it's like, it's all a lot of fun and it's all solid enough that you can get started. And then where it goes, they get good as they go, like they get really interesting. And that's
because their characters start to develop.
Right. The characters develop, their art style develops, and even their storytelling ability. I think their narrative ability to weave a narrative, even with all the kooky shit they were throwing into that comic, like really starts to drive home. Armageddon Quest from page one is like Ron has done his early issues. That's all out of the way. This is like where it gets good
and fully fleshed.
Right from page one, you are, I think when I put art, the first couple of pages of art on the screen and share it with people, I think a lot of folks and artists especially have looked at it and been like, this is detailed. This is like really finely wrought. This is well done. This is very good. And I'm like, some of his early stuff is shakier. Don't get me wrong. Like it absolutely is, but not by the time he started doing this. And now he's firing on all cylinders.
The art is endearing when you're looking at it.
I agree.
You know, I think that's the way you're not looking at it and going, oh my God, that's Jim Lee doing Batman Hush, you know, where he's blowing you out of the water with the art that this isn't about that. This is, you know, when you look at the characters, it's easy to be like, oh, it's, I don't want to, it's not cute, but it's cute for, you know what I mean? It's endearing.
I call it charming. That's
the best way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's charming and endearing. And it's like, oh, and it probably makes, when you start to read it and it's obviously going to get very heavy, it probably makes those heavier themes easier to explain and easier to be a part of and to relate to. That's the thing. Yeah. That's what I'm wondering when you're reading it and you're, you know, 10, 11 years old and you're in your back of your parents' car going down the road and you're at page 750 and Tazo is doing something or experiencing something for the first time. That's a very adult situation. But they put it in an art form that makes it so much easier for you to relate to. You probably like, click, 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 click.
Right. Well, and he's a child too, like in these early issues, right? So he's coming into this world a lot of, like, me as a reader at that age, especially, I probably was able to dial into that. And then, yeah, that his art style, but even his storytelling style to some degree is very, it's also charming. It's also got this, whether you want to call it naivete, whether you want to call it charm, whether you want to call it sweetness, like there's this very openness where it's part of what also makes the sexuality elements of it, once we get there, also feel way ahead of its time, is like he's doing all this super very honest graphic stuff, but it's very on, it's very open, it's just very almost wide-eyed and innocent about the whole thing, to where it's like, this is all wonderful and acceptable. It can get dark, it can get bad, and that's decisions characters make, and we're gonna look into that and we're gonna explore that. But even then, we're gonna look at these characters for who they are and where their moral boundaries are. And it's just the way he does it is in a way that, especially as a kid, but I think adult, I mean, even as an adult, I keep rereading it and getting blown away by it. Every time I revisit it, I'm always shocked by how deft the writing is and nuanced his approach to these themes are, where it's just, there's so much that goes on in this comic and so many ideas and themes, events, I don't want to call it politics, but, you know, things we would now think are political in nature. But at the time, I think he was just like, this is humanity. This is life, which is kind of the truth of a lot of things we call politics. Right. It's like, it's unavoidable. It is life.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was interested in the project, and guys, go out to Kickstarter right now and go to ArmageddonQuest.com. You can see it, how it's written. Armageddon Quest on the bottom of their screen right there. If you're listening on your podcast, in your car, or on your headset, whatever, it's just ArmageddonQuest.com. Take you right to the Kickstarter page. And we're going to get into the Kickstarter here in a second. And you can see all the cool stuff. When you talked about this for the first time, I was like, I didn't understand that it was something that came from before. Cause you asked me about it. Have you heard of this book? Cause I think you're on a quest to find somebody else that understood this book. And I'm old enough to be like, there's a good chance I could have heard of it. But I was like, no, I've never even heard of that book. And you're like, God damn it. And it's interesting. I was so blown away by the fact that here's somebody that was so moved by a book that wants to bring it back to share it because it's out. You know what I mean? You can't just find it. You can go to eBay. You can look up Armageddon Quest and you can find some of those older stuff.
Find copies. Yep.
Yeah. But, you know, the fact that you want to bring it back into print and make it available to a larger audience, I just was so intrigued, you know. And then to go in and obviously the passion that you have for this, and it just reminds me, like, when I was growing up, the first comic book I ever fell in love with, like, that I had books, comic books that my dad had, which when he was, my dad was born in 1940, right, and my grandparents still had all his old comic books in an old wooden chest in his thing, and they're like Batman and Superman and a bunch of Disney ones, but they're all torn up. They're right. I mean, they went through grandkids and cousins and everything. And I read those, but I don't.
That was an era that no one was taking care of. Comic, they weren't made to be taken care of.
Right? No. That was in the 70s when I was reading those, and I don't remember even which ones they were. I just kind of remember maybe Superman was in there, maybe Batman. But my brother collected, and my brother is 5-6 years older than me. And he got Magic, the character Magic from the X-Men, and he got her miniseries. And that was the first one that I really, really remember reading, sitting down, and was like, that was it. And then about 2 years later, the Dark Knight Returns, the graphic novel with all of them connected. And I read, and my buddy Jerry, who lived right up the street, Ben, we called him Jerry, but his name was Ben Duenas. And he used to let me read his comic books, and he was like 10 years older than me. Right. And he was super nice guy, but he let me read his comic books. And that was the first one he let me borrow. And I probably read The Dark Knight Returns, and I don't know how many times, like over and over, and I almost ruined his book, and he went and bought me a copy. Just so
he should have just been like, you keep that beaten up one now. I'm gonna go buy myself.
I think that's what he ended up doing. I think that's what we ended up doing is I just kept that one.
Good.
And I probably read that book no less than 50 times growing up. Yeah. And then I really got into Batman, the Killing Joke, which is kind of funny because I was always like a Spider-Man guy and an X-Men guy. Those were like my favorite ones to read, but those two Batman stories really stuck with me. And I remember reading The Killing Joke thinking, oh my God, this was amazing, blah, blah, blah. And then I got into Swamp Thing because I wanted to know more about Alan Moore. But then I wasn't a fan of The Watchmen, really. I loved the movie more than I liked the comic books, which is kind of, which is probably sacrilegious. But I just wasn't a big fan of it. And then, but The Killing Joke, I really liked. And then when I read it when I was an adult, I was like, I didn't have the connection. Where you have this book that you still want to go back to, and you can still, and 900 pages is nothing to sneeze at. That means you could open it up and start reading something and being like, oh, and you can like transport yourself right back to that.
Honestly, it gets better as I get older.
Yeah.
It's been, I mean, I can say that about a handful of comics. And those are all going to be my like top five. It's interesting. We won't go into the list right now, but I've made it up to someone on another podcast challenged me to get my top five, and I did. And I've now expanded that. I think I've discovered what I think right now I would call my top eight of all time.
Mine
and they're all
so
black
much.
And white. They're all black and white comics, which actually kind of shocked
me. That's hilarious.
I'm like, really? I'm like, I would not, as much as I love like, Armageddon Quest, I didn't think I loved black and white comics that much, but so far.
Like The Crow and Grendel and.
No, it's mostly going to be shit you also haven't heard about, let me tell you.
Yeah. Is it Faust? Some people,
No. So I've never actually read Faust. I know of it. And I actually love David Quinn, the writer.
Oh, my God. I remember when it came out and me and all my buddies were like, oh, my God, this is amazing. And I look back at it now and I'm like, oh, my God, it was just over the top violence and sex. There's a scene where a guy gets his penis cut off and you see it flying across the room.
I've seen pages, like I've seen snippets of it. And I'm like, and one day I am so curious. I'm like, I need to read that the series as a whole now that it's all available.
I said, didn't Tim Vigil do the art for that?
Yep. Almost all of it. Yeah. I believe. Yeah. I think there are a few chapters where some pinch hitters came in, but he was the main artist on most of it.
But
I think the Armageddon Quest is one that the older I get and the more I return to it, the more I just marvel.
That's
over
awesome.
It. And yeah. And it, I don't.
That's awesome.
This campaign has been me trying to put it into words. Why? You know, and like the struggle to do that. But yeah.
We have 6 days to go. We're at $1,666 of a pledge of $3,000, $20 of which of it is mine. So,
yay. Thank you, Ken.
Let's get it over the hump. I know you probably have some people waiting in their wings, which drives me nuts.
Oh, it's I know. Like, I've got 130 followers that are just sitting there following the campaign.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
please,
all right,
please.
It's like down to the wire. I get it.
Yeah.
But and doing what I can, and we'll see. And I will say, you know, I still have confidence. 6 days, like of so many campaigns have turned it around in six
we're
days
get it.
In those
we're
final
get
days.
It. Yeah.
I still have confidence.
We had the Dracula guy just the other last month, remember? Uh-huh. They're gonna drop it and everything. They're gonna cancel it.
Yeah.
And they were able
and
to turn
they made
it around.
It.
Yeah.
John Westhoff, who just did Drumsticks of Doom, this is like the first campaign he's ever done where it's just like funded. And it's always been down to the wire with him. Stephen Prince, too, until like just this campaign or the one before it, was always down to the wire with his Monster Matador. And this one just funded right out the gate. So you finally hit this stride, I think, if you can just keep going. But at the beginning, this is the
it's
way
growing
it is.
That, it's growing that audience.
And awareness. So even if this fails, like I'll probably need a few more bells and whistles, like a few higher tiers to get people to drop a few more bucks. But I think the more awareness people have, and I'm getting better at knowing how to reach people, where it took this campaign for me to get better at it.
Well,
and so
if
I think
you
I can
unlock
the
golden
the
palace
time.
On how to build that awareness, please let me know.
I will let you know. Every trick. I mean, we're on all the Discords and all the Facebook groups, we're sharing what we learn. But there are things that like I didn't think about until way too late, and it's too late really to start it now. but there are some big names I could have reached out to and I totally forgotten about it because I backed so much of their stuff. And anyway, there are two hints, there are tricks here, but let's get into this for now. Welcome, everybody, to the very first Kickstarter. By me, I'm Dave Baxter, the host of the Wine and Comics Pairing Show, which is a YouTube show and podcast. Does exactly what it says in the title. We paired wines with comics. And this is the very first Kickstarter for our Wine and Comics Publishing branch. Get it? Wine and Comics Pairing Show, Wine and Comics Publishing, kind of the same acronym. It's clever. Okay. For this very first Kickstarter, we are bringing back into print my favorite comic book of all time, Armageddon Quest by Ronald Russell Roach. Bing! Book one, Tazio. And actually, so you can see this properly, let's flip this video. There we go. Now you can read it properly. See the insides of the comic. Ooh, so pretty. It is black and white. It is properly black and white, as you can see here. Oh, yay. So good. So beautiful. Ronald Russell Roach, right? All right. This is my bad side, so let's flip this back. All right. Beautiful. For this campaign, we have not just the main cover. We also have an alternate cover by USA bestselling author Russell Nolte, best known for Katrina Hates the Dead, his Godverse Chronicle novels, Ichabod Jones' Monster Hunter, Cthulhu is Hard to Spell anthologies. If you love Russell, he also does this wonderful underground DIY art style, and I love what he did with Tazio right here, so this is one of the alternate covers. And then we have a gorgeous wraparound cover by Angela Odling. Check that out down below. We also have two t-shirts in the spirit of the comic, one that is safe for work and one that is not safe for work, depending on how many people you want to offend. You can choose which t-shirt is for you. We will also have stretch goals coming, mostly digital stretch goals, because we want both our digital and physical backers to be able to partake of all the stretch goals we hit. We have a 12-page full-color prelude story to Armageddon Quest called Mother Instinct, which has rarely ever been seen in the wild. And we are going to give all backers this story if we hit a certain stretch goal. We also have music that Ron has done. Ron never did music specifically for Armageddon Quest, but we do have an epic 8-minute Star Trek song that he wrote all the lyrics and music and performs, and people will be able to get a downloadable version of that music if we hit that stretch goal. And then we have whole graphic novels from other indie comic creators that will be coming up as stretch goals as well. Back if you can, and let's hit these stretch goals of number of backers and total amount raised.
Boom. There we go. So, we are into the story. So, if you love Eastman and Laird's original black and white TMNT, Osamu Tezuka's Astro Boy, or Stan Sakai's Usagi Yojimbo, Dave Sims' Cerebus, Cerebus was huge.
Yep. I was into it. I loved it. I discovered it after Armageddon Quest, but I read all the phone books.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy how big of a comic that actually became. You know what indie book I used to love was Concrete. Did you ever read that one?
Yeah. Not till later. Concrete was one that missed me until like I was adult. So I never got the issues, though they were coming out when I was a kid.
The best
Cerebus, I definitely did.
It's funny that I missed Armageddon Quest, because the best place to see independent books in the 80s and early 90s was the Bud Plant catalog.
Oh, yeah.
And they would just have...
Sirius was in there, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, Cerebus was in there. That's how I found out.
Oh, sorry, Sirius, the S-I-R-I-U-S.
Yeah, the publisher.
I know, it sounds the same.
Dawn, yeah.
Yes.
And then... that's how I found Concrete. That's how I found Cerebus. That's how, yeah. So it's kind of funny. I probably saw the title, but.
Maybe. I think one thing that Sirius did that was a mistake is they released each graphic novel monthly. So it was just like 1, 2, 3, done.
Yeah.
And so the whole thing was out by then. And it's one of the reasons we're doing single issues right now is to build the audience slowly over time. Is I think the 1, 2, 3 and out, and then the marketing, you know, the marketing campaign's over. Now all the copies are just scattered in the wild. And if you noticed it, you noticed it. And if you didn't, it's over.
Yeah.
And there was just no, like, Concrete were mini series that came out once a year that were 4 or 5 issues at a time that just kept building on each other. And so same thing with Cerebus, 300 issues. I mean, like, it had time. TMNT, same thing. Like, everything that made it big had time to make it big. And I think Armageddon, one of the reasons Armageddon Quest just fell through the cracks is it was all done. And I think Sirius was awesome for getting it all out there, but I think they did it so fast, so blitzkrieg, that there was no anticipation. There was no building that, like, they should have done one trade paperback a year and waited like given it like 3 years to do it or something of that nature. And it was just way too fast.
Yeah. So AQ is the Black and White Underground Comics epic for singular voice writer artist Ronald Russell Roach, or 3R. Crafted between 84 and 92. It's coming age tale of our Antichrist, Tazio, but of course he's a reluctant one and a nice kid who doesn't want to hurt anybody. Please note, this is not safe for work, blah, you know, all of the things that we've already talked about. Look at some of these. I love some of this work. So our head edition of AQ with giant white space above and below, right, are new. So now you get to see the difference of bringing it up more into the modern era of comic books.
Right. Where you no longer have to have a standard size, where it's like, whatever the page is, doesn't matter. We're squeezing it into this, you know, 8.5 by 10 and something. And it's like, nope, this is actually like a 6 and something by 9 and something. So let's get it down to that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you have some stretch goals. New intro by Joshua Dysart. Who is Joshua Dysart?
So Dysart. Joshua Dysart is the writer. He wrote the Vertigo Unknown Soldier, and he did Swamp Thing for a couple of years. And he did Harbinger, the Win Valiant originally relaunched, not the current new Valiant, but like the original, you know, relaunch of Valiant. Joshua was the Harbinger guy. He wrote it for pretty much its entire run.
Was that 2014, 2015?
Yeah, 2014, 2015. And then most recently, he's done 2 Bad Idea series, Orc Island and Odin's Eye. So, and he's a New York Times bestselling. I think that from Unknown Soldier was his New York Times bestselling graphic novels. And yeah, I'll do the story quickly. But his story is really cool because I befriended Josh like over a decade ago, and we're both in LA, but we only see each other like once a year or something like that. Sure. And one year I was talking about Armageddon Quest, and I was trying, this was when I was getting pull quotes from people, when I got it from Scott McCloud, when I got it from Warren Ellis. And I asked, I was like, I gave him a copy of the first trade paperback from the old version of the trade paperback. And I was like, read it, see what you think. And so we read it and we met up, and later I was like, so do you think you can give me a pull quote? And he said, no, I don't think I can. I don't think I like it. And I was like, oh, okay. And he's like, yeah, it breaks all the rules that are good rules. They're necessary rules. And I don't think this is how you're supposed to tell a good story. And I was like, all right, cool, fine. You know, no harm, no foul, all good. You know, and we went our merry way. We stayed in touch. We stayed friends. It didn't end the friendship. When I was gearing up for this Kickstarter, we were catching up for just life, you know, kind of a thing, like, hey, how you doing? Ever since the pandemic, it's all been emails. Like, we almost never even get together in person anymore because we're so lazy and bad about it. But we were emailing back and forth, and I was telling him, hey, we're going to do this again. And he said, I've been meaning to tell you, I fucking love Armageddon Quest now. And I was like, what? And he was like, I was like, oh, I'm like, well, I'm glad. And he's like, yeah, and I said, I'm glad you can appreciate it now. And he's like, no, I didn't say I appreciate it. I said, I fucking love it. And he's like, I think it's a true underground work of art. And I feel like that's a awesome. Fucking idiot. It took me this long to get to understand that and to appreciate it for what it is. But he's like, this is so my jam, so my bag. And I thought that was such a perfect story of, it's almost like the worst case scenario story for people in my head, where it's like, you might not love it like I did right out the gate. You might not be like, this, what is this? This is incredible. Because we're all different. We're not all going to have the same response to anything, whatever it is. But I do think it is a unique enough work and a well-crafted enough work that you're going to remember it. Josh hated it, but kept going back to it. And he couldn't leave it alone. And then this guy, who is a writer by trade, that's what he does. I mean, that's what he does for a living. He has no day job. He has no anything else. Yeah. He writes for a living, and he writes comics predominantly for a living. And he came back to it until he was like, this is a gem. This is what brave writing is. And I'm so he's going to be writing that intro, telling that story and giving his thoughts on the comic. And
nice.
He hasn't sent me the draft of the intro yet, but I've already tagged him on social media and he's like, shit, I got to get that to you. And I'm like, yes, you do. We're running out of time. But he will be writing that intro. And I'm excited to have people read what his thoughts on this.
It's awesome. And then some great sample pages showing. I mean, that's great looking.
It is. I'm telling you, it's like a lot of people look at this art and it's like, it's not. Ron always describes his art as crude. And I'm like, I don't think crude's the right word, man.
I don't think
I'm
it's crude.
It's really well drafted. And it's got detail. It's great composition. And the expressions are amazing. I've always been blown away by this art and the way he'll even fit, because it's all hand lettered text and you know, sound effects. It's all part of the art. This was at a time there were no computers, there was none of that, so it's all drawn into the page.
There's a lot of detail.
It's amazing. Yeah, and there's a lot of text, so it's kind of fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And these sample pages, this is the light version of text. Wait until you get into the thick of the comic. And I love this splash page. I think the splash page, this is the, you know, a quick snapshot of all the things to come, of what's coming up. And so you get a quick peek to sort of wet everyone's whistle. And then a quick sample below that of the not safe for work. Just it's like, trust me, not safe for work.
Not safe for work, not safe for work, not safe for work.
Like every panel, when the page is hit, it's every panel.
And then here's your Russell Nolte cover.
Russell Nolte, for those who know him from Cthulhu's Hard to Spell and Ichabod Jones, Monster Hunter, Katrina Hates Dead, God vs. Chronicles, blah, blah, blah. He does art, and I love that. And then Angela Odling there for the wraparound cover.
Yeah, I like this cover.
It's so good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
This is interesting. I like how you did this. I'm a little jealous of this print
graphic
right here.
Or
the graphic and how you did the first 10.
Yeah.
Because we did stickers.
A sticker, I know.
And
so
then
I was hoping. Right. Yeah, I was hoping this would be a nice step up from that, where I'm like, okay, I'm just going to print these in batches of 10. They will be the first order. Like the printer's going to print those first. They're literally going to be there. So it's a little extra costly in that regard, because, of course, it's its own interior front cover printing that none of the other copies are going to have. And then I will hand number them.
It looks great. It's a great way of doing it.
Cool.
And then
I thought so, but
T-shirts. I'm surprised. I didn't want to do T-shirts. I was so worried about having to deal with T-shirts.
I mean, it's the only thing I'm doing outside of the comics. So it's kind of like, it's my one real bell and whistle that I'm doing. I think if this doesn't make it to the goal, I need to get more like prints and things like that. And maybe some
I could tell you this, the prints.
I know
everybody I talked to in my thing with prints, I was super lucky. My office is
You got what? Ron Randall, right?
Yeah, Ron Randall.
Did
a cool print. Not one sold. Not one print sold. Bundles had prints in them sold.
There you go.
But,
gotcha.
But apparently prints sell really well at conventions.
Yeah.
Cons.
Yeah. I think cons. And but again, I think I need like a top tier bundle with like a whole bunch of shit in it. And that might move the needle a little faster.
Yep. I like how you did the stretch goals with the
The Jewish Kabbalah. Yes.
Yeah.
Spiritual, religious Jewish Kabbalah. And I'm like, yep, that fits this comic. Let's do it.
And then
we are all about sacrilege here.
Yeah. The PDF. That's just a digital copy. Yep. The physical cover, main cover A, cover B for 20. Is this the early bird? No, I did the
No. Yeah. These are the normal prices. Early bird, the PDF was $6, and then the main cover was 10. They were all like $5 cheaper. And then every physical issue does come with the PDF and the digital indie comic bundle. Like, they're all included. Every time you go up a tier, everything before it is included. None of them are not.
Yeah. And then we have the wraparound cover, which is great.
Amen. And then we just decreased the price of the t-shirt. They were $45. There were no bites on the t-shirt. So I'm like, you know what? I did the math again and I'm like, you know what? If we fund, I can do these for,
you can swing, they the cost 35. More.
They cost more to print than 35, but if we fund, that will cover that cost anyway. So I'm like, all right, let's see if anyone will take them for $35.
Yeah, this is actually a really good point right here, what Dave just said. When you're looking at a why things cost what they cost, when you're looking at Kickstarter, you go to a comic book store and you see a Marvel book for, what are they now, $3.99, $4.99?
$4.99 mostly.
Yeah, $4.99. And you look at a creator-owned independent book and it's, you know, $10 to $20. Right. And it's because we're not printing in 100,000 copy batches. Right. We're printing in 1,000 batches, which,
and usually digital and not offset, because we're not doing those huge numbers. So you can't do offset and that increases price.
Our production costs are so much more that this is why.
And
the fact that he has to sell a shirt less than what he has to get it printed for.
Right.
Now you know.
Right. Now you know. I mean, I will even say they technically cut each of those shirts, because they're front and back, and maybe that's something I have to relook at and only do a simpler shirt, but they are $42 to print a pop. So unless I was printing huge numbers, but you know, I would need like 100 people to get that t-shirt, which ain't gonna happen. And don't forget, guys, shipping too. Like, we are often trying to make sure shipping is covered as much as possible. Like, there might be a small shipping fee that's at like a flat fee, like $5 more for shipping, but shipping costs more than that. So it's like, we are including shipping, that in,
shipping is expensive, and it just went up again in January.
Yes it did. So the cost includes and we're trying to not have hidden costs. So, you know, we don't want to do that thing where it's like $10 for the comic, and then we'll let you know what the shipping is when the time comes, and then the shipping is like more $12, which is more than the comic. And it's like, we don't want to do that. So instead, we're like, make the comic $15 plus $5 shipping, and then whatever the shipping is, fine. We can swallow that difference.
That's what we did. That's exactly what I did.
We get close enough that
international,
it's okay,
though,
it's not gonna break us. Yeah.
International was $30. And I had some international people, which I was shocked. I was like, I don't want to charge them $30, but
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. $30. And it's $37 for the, I'm shipping one to Australia. It's $37.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone took the first 10 and they're in Malta.
Yeah.
And so I'm just like, all right, we're going to cross that bridge.
Then my next one, it's going up to $40. And it's not because I want to charge them that, but I can't pay into it. You know what I mean? Right. It just breaks the bank.
I'm doing the flat fee. So like international, I believe domestic is $5, international is $15, no matter where it's going. And I'm gonna swallow whatever the difference is after that.
Yeah.
I made the comics more than they cost to print, to make sure there is a margin of error.
Yeah.
You know, between that, so that whatever, if I have to swallow costs, and there will be some, those international packages, I will definitely have to swallow some costs. Go over, but that overage should be bearable rather than, you know, if I was charging you $5 for the comic, those overages would be impossible, you know, for us to cover as indie creators. So that's
it'd
a
be
big
nice
piece
to find a printer that has partnerships in different countries, so they can do all the setup and you just send the file to an Australian printer. They print out the $5 and then you can ship it right from there.
Right. Well, I'm printing through a UK based printer, so we'll see. I actually don't know about that, but I might find out once I know what my international shipping packages might be. I might be able to do their based. They have places in the US and then their primary place is UK, so it might be cheaper to have a certain number of copies printed there.
I can't believe I don't know this book. So here's Ronald Russell Roach, born in Seattle in the early 60s, studied at Western Washington State. I mean, this is all my backyard. College in Bellingham, majoring in English. He traveled over the world and was part of the 1960s, 70s hippie scene. His first published comic was Space Bum, which is published in the Space.com books by Print Mint in 1972. He continued drawing his own comics through 70s and 80s. He created Armageddon Quest, a mini comic book that was published under the Starhead Comics label from 84 to 86, which I think isn't Starhead from this area, from Seattle?
Probably. That's probably how we met him. Yeah.
It's just kind of, it's always shocking.
You know, I have. Well, hold on.
That's amazing.
So here's the Starhead comic.
Okay. Ta-da. Oh, yeah.
And let me see.
That's the original.
This is the very first single issue that was actually printed way back in the day. That's the one in the photo when I'm comparing the two.
So yeah.
It's got the yellowed edges and everything on the thing. But I was going to
probably see smells like the 80s.
Yeah. I was going to see if they had something like, okay, yes, he's in Denmark and Seattle, Washington, Starhead Comics. Yep.
How do I not know about this book? I mean, dude, 1985, I was 11 and I was at the comic book store every day, like literally at the paperback exchange.
Well, you should have.
I should have. That's so weird. It's kind of crazy.
I mean, I don't have answers for why people don't know this book. I just don't know. All I know is they don't. And that is like just reality.
Do you know Stephen Frank?
That name sounds familiar.
Stephen Frank was the animated director on the What If from this year and last year.
Okay.
And then on Disney Plus, he was also the animation supervisor on The Iron Giant.
Ooh.
And And he's done a ton of animation stuff, but he's has his own comic book called Silver, which is a Griff in Dracula's castle. It's all in black and white.
That's why I know. And Palomino is what he's doing now.
Yes. I'm in Palomino. I'm in the second volume.
Are you in it? I haven't read them yet, but I have all three of the ones that have come out. So
that guy's an amazing storyteller. You need to have him on your, you need to reach out to him and have him on your comic book, on your show, because he's one of my favorite. When he comes when he comes to town, I take him to dinner every time.
Okay.
Cause I love that guy. He's out of France. Well, he lives in LA, but you know, he's originally from France. He, asked him to tell him about his granddad escaped. He escaped the concentration camps, not once, but twice. Yeah. And he's got some great stories, loves art, loves comics, loves animated movies. We'll talk your ear off about all of it and understanding it. I bet you I'd be shocked if he doesn't know Armageddon Quest, because I feel like he knows everything.
I'm telling you, man, I just don't find, I hear you and I'd be interested to find out. And I do need to reach out to him, especially if he's in the LA area. I'm like, oh yeah, right. Duh.
Yeah.
I think the only reason I haven't thought of him in a little while is because after Palomino 2 and 3, you know, he's been doing his own, like, I haven't heard from him on the Kickstarter.
He's been working on What If.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I will definitely have to reach out to him and tell him you sent me.
Tell him I sent you. He'll be like, oh, yeah. I'd be confident he won't be like, oh, who?
No. Yeah.
Because that happens a lot, right? You talk to somebody, especially when you have a podcast and you have all these people that come through.
From Seattle? Is this ringing any bells? Yeah. Your one Seattle friend, I'm going to assume, maybe. I would love to find more people that know this book, but it just never happened. It so rarely happens. I find some professionals in the comic scene that somehow knew about this work, like somewhere down the line, because they were so voraciously a part of the scene during that time. They know of Armageddon Quest, but readers, fucking A. I cannot find readers who ever noticed this comic. And I don't know why. They just didn't.
Well, get out to Kickstarter. Please go to ArmageddonQuest.com and, you know, read through the Kickstarter and help us out. Get us over that hump. We love being at 1666, but we need to get to 3.
And it's till February 14th, guys. I think it's early on February 14th. It ends like noon or something like that. So really February 13th, we have 6 days left to raise the final 44%. I think we're 56% raised and 44% to go. That is not unheard of whatsoever on Kickstarter campaigns until those final days. But just make my life easier. Don't make me sweat so many bullets.
And listen, if you're not in a position to actually purchase and get into it, then share it out. Share it out on your social medias, please. And your Facebook, your Twitters. That does more help than you know, because maybe
new
if you're not into it, or if you can't afford
it yet, yeah,
one of your friends might love it and might be into it. So give it a chance. All right, guys, I think that's it for today. I really appreciate you coming in and signing on and hanging out with us, Dave. It's always awesome to hang out with you. So that was fun. Don't forget, everybody listening out there, open the mind, read more.
Spaghetti.